No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the State House File, and your host. This is a special recorded version of No Limits, which means we won't be taking calls or getting emails or comments or questions via social media. My guest is U.S. Representative Larry Bouchon, who is a congressman from the southwest portion of Indiana. Representative Bouchon, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's good to have you here. Probably ought to start by talking a little bit. I mean, your profile is somewhat distinctive for Congress in that you came not from a legal or public policy background, but you're actually a medical doctor.
Yeah, before I was in Congress, I was a practicing cardiovascular and thoracic surgeon in Evansville for 12 years, and 3 years prior to that, I was in Wichita, Kansas. So, it is an unusual background, but I tell you, medical people are well-equipped to be in Congress. You know, we're trained to look at data, evaluate data, and kind of come to a decision about what we think is the best approach, and honestly, Congress isn't much different.
I would assume the opportunities for diagnosis there are significant.
There's a lot of most of the diagnoses sometimes aren't good. But
what prompted you? I mean, it sounds like you left a very successful medical practice to run for Congress. What prompted you to do that? To think that politics might be something you'd be interested in?
Well, I've always been interested in politics and public policy, and I've always followed it along, kind of as a political junkie. And really, the situation with health care, mm-hmm. you know, which is going to be ongoing for our lifetimes, right? Because there's a lot of changes that are happening in health care, need to happen. Health care reform needed to be done. In the way it's been done, of course, I don't think is necessarily the right approach. But everyone recognized that health care is too expensive, and not everyone had coverage. Not everyone had access. So I really thought a medical voice in Congress could be part of that conversation, and so that's why I ran.
What is it that you object to about the Affordable Care Act, what we call health care reform?
Yeah, the main thing is I think it's more of a government approach rather than a private sector approach. And I think the government can encourage, you know, the private sector to make reforms necessary to get the cost of health care down, which is really the other overriding issue that I don't think is well addressed in the Affordable Care Act, which is the cost. And, you know, you can provide people coverage, but if the cost of health care continues to grow three times the normal economy, all the rest of the economy, which it has for a couple of decades, then you're really not going to get ahead of that. And the problem in health care is we need more price transparency. The consumer needs to know what it costs. And we need quality transparency so the consumer knows what the quality of the product they're receiving is, just like any other product that you might buy. And in healthcare, it's been a price-fixed market. Nobody knows what it costs because of third-party paying. Those are issues that need to be addressed that aren't addressed really in the Affordable Care Act. There are positive things in the Affordable Care Act that we needed to address: pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps, young people getting help on their parents' policies until they get their feet on the ground. All of those things are things that we needed to address. And to a certain extent, even though it is Medicaid expansion, there are some people who have gotten at least Medicaid coverage that they didn't have before. So there are some positives in the law. I mean, the intent is good. No one, I don't think, is questioning the intent. But I don't think it's going to address the cost in a meaningful way, and that's the big issue.
You say now that no one is questioning the intent, but obviously when it became law, a lot of people were.
Well, I don't think
I'm trying to think of the word, but that was one of the more divisive issues in modern political history. And I have noticed on both sides that the temperature of the rhetoric has dropped considerably in the past few months, that on the Republican side, it's stopped being quite as much repeal ACA or Obamacare as much as it has been reform it. What accounts for that sort of change in the tone of the discussion about it?
Yeah, what I meant by the intent is I think everyone in the United States, regardless of political party, regardless of where you're from, wants everyone to have access to quality, affordable health care. And I think that was the intent of the law from the president's perspective and from the supporters of the law's perspective. That's what I meant by I don't think anyone in questioning that is questioning that as the intent of the law. But I think, you know, the reality is now that, you know, the law has been in place for 5 years. There are some things that, you know, that with the pre-existing conditions and other things that have been effective, which needed to be changed before. As a physician, I had patients that had pre-existing conditions, couldn't get insurance. But I think the reality is that, you know, the way the insurance market has dramatically changed based on the ACA. For example, there's really not a significant non-exchange individual or small group policies available at an affordable price. That, you know, repealing the law in the short term is not something that, you know, is going to make a quick change and get us back to where we were before, because there's just been dramatic changes made. And so I think you're starting to see people talk about, well, let's look at what parts of the law that maybe need adjusted. And over time, you know, try to get us back to where we have a competitive private sector market, a non-ACA private sector market. But I do think the ACA, some of it will still continue to be in place. That's just the political and practical reality of it. And I think people have recognized that. You know, before the law was implemented, when I first came into Congress, repealing the law before it started was practical. I think now the way the law is, although I think many parts of it eventually will not be in place 10 years from now, repealing the whole law probably is not politically or practically going to happen.
What parts of the law do you think won't be in place 10 years from now?
Yeah, I think that the exchange situation with the subsidized exchanges, if we can reestablish a competitive private sector market, are going to be difficult to maintain. The reason I say that, let me give you an example that one of my colleagues from Alabama just told me, that in Alabama, 85 or so percent of the marketplace, 80-85% is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama. And they're losing millions and millions of dollars on the exchange policies. He quoted $100 million, but I haven't seen that firsthand. So, but millions of dollars, put it that way. And so they're raising their premiums. They're asking for a significant raise in premiums, 25 to 30% ballpark. And, you know, if they can't continue to be profitable and make money on that, they have said that they'll have to consider dropping out of the exchange marketplace. So I think it's going to be difficult to maintain the exchange marketplace in its current form because of the lack of profitability for the insurance companies. And that's where I think with time you'll see reestablishment of a private sector healthcare market for individuals and small groups. So will the exchanges still be there in some areas? Probably. But I think that's one area that's a big challenge. You know, I think some of the mandates the business mandate, which has never been implemented, the mandate for businesses to provide coverage, has never been implemented primarily for political reasons. But there are practical reasons for it, too, because people are concerned that businesses will drop their health coverage for their, you know, their private health coverage for their employees and just have their employees go on the exchanges. And businesses, more than 50 employees, have told us that. So I think there'll be some adjustments in those areas. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that I support, pre-existing conditions, children till 26, and those type of things will still be in law.
Do you worry? I mean, obviously there's a portion of it in front of the court right now, and I have heard some Republicans saying, oh, gosh, you know, maybe 3 years ago we would have wanted the court to step in and decide this, but not so much now, because then, you know, we would have to deal. There are parts of the law, as you've pointed out, that are unpopular, but there are some parts of it that are very popular and that, you know, people now would not want to be without.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think the Supreme Court ruling in King v. Burwell, if King wins the case, you know, there'll be 6 or 7 million people at risk of losing their health insurance based on the fact they'll lose their subsidy and won't be able to afford it. We're not going to let that happen. Republicans and Democrats recognize the practical aspect of this. The law has been in place for 5 years. People need to be held harmless. 6 or 7 million people are not going to lose their coverage. That's not acceptable. I think the court will probably, my personal view is, even if King wins the case, I think will probably extend the subsidies for a certain period of time. You know, I think the president's solution would be to change the law to allow the subsidies to be given, federally established exchanges. The reality is we don't have the votes in Congress to do that. Mm-hmm. So the alternative is to try to find another solution that makes sure that 6 or 7 million people don't lose their health insurance. And I think those alternatives are out there. I think we can continue in the short run to make sure that I would say over 18 months to 2 years that people are able to have the financial support they need to keep their insurance. But also my hope is transition a little bit to, like I said earlier, help reestablish in the states as a state-based way, small group and markets, individual marketplace that are affordable. And I think we can do that, and that'd be the goal.
You said with the president's approach to extend it, you know, basically through a federal approach.
Yeah.
But that there aren't the votes in Congress. I probably would be remiss if I didn't ask, where would you vote on that?
Well, I wouldn't support that. I wouldn't support just a direct change in the law. And the reason is because I don't think that in the long run that's going to solve our problem. As I mentioned earlier in your show, the exchanges are one area I think they're on really shaky ground because of the finances. And I think that, you know, extending the subsidies just with a couple-word change in the law really isn't addressing our long-term problem with the exchanges and the viability of the exchanges.
How would you what would you put in place to replace, strengthen, supplement, reform the exchanges then?
Well, I think, like I said, in the short term, we're going to need to hold people harmless. I think if the court doesn't extend the exchanges, subsidies, I think in the short run, Congress will do that for probably 18 months to 2 years in some form.
Yeah, I'm talking more about a long term.
Yeah, in the long term, I think the hope would be is that we would reestablish a more state-based way to address it. In the short term, block grants to the states to allow them to help their citizens afford health care, insurance. But we really need to get the private sector market back in place, you know, on the non-exchange marketplace. And insurance companies have said, and state legislatures have said, they're willing to do that. Because, you know, insurance has been state-based for the most part. The states all run their own insurance departments. And so we're going to work towards trying to get the states to have the flexibility to reestablish in their states a viable private sector health market that's affordable. Now, you know, that's a long-term goal. In the short term, we'll see what happens. But I think for the long term, on the exchange side, we need to have competition for the exchange policies. Without competition, it's going to be difficult. The cost continues to go up. And, you know, the subsidy cost is going to continue to go up. And honestly, from what we're hearing, the profitability of the insurance companies' policies in that marketplace are not, you know, something that they can sustain. So, you know, the health insurance market is very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very broken. And it has been for years. So I think that, you know, we need short-term goals, make sure people are held harmless, long-term goals of trying to reestablish a cost-effective private sector marketplace.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Congressman Larry Bouchon. He is a Republican from Southwest Indiana. We've been talking about health care reform. This is a recorded show, which means that we aren't taking calls, we aren't getting emails, we aren't taking questions or comments via social media. But we do hope that you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking in this special recorded show with U.S. Representative Larry Bouchon. He's a Republican from Southwest Indiana. Because this is a recorded show, we are not taking calls or emails or questions or comments via social media. We do hope you're enjoying the conversation. Before the break, we were talking really about the Affordable Care Act and both its present, its past, its present, and its future. I'd like to talk, we'd started talking a little bit about sort of a change in the tone when we're talking about health care and health care reform, in that the level of the rhetoric seems to have been damped down a little bit on both sides of the equation, that there is more of a spirit of discussion rather than argument or debate. And one of the things I'd like to talk a bit about is 21st century cures, something that you've been intimately involved in, an approach. But before we get to that, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we got to this new point in the discussion, what you think might have accounted for the dampening of the rhetoric and some of the animosity associated with
it. Yeah, I think, like I said in the last segment, that everybody's goal on health care is to make sure everybody has quality, affordable health care, no, regardless of where your zip code is. And I think, as a physician, I took care of people regardless of their ability to pay or where they were from. Medical doctors take care of people. That's what we do. And I think from a political standpoint in Washington, the Doctors Caucus, there's about 20 of us, including doctors, psychologists, nurses, dentists. Since I've gotten into Congress, we've kind of developed a critical mass of people that can talk health care. And I think at least on our side of the aisle, we talk about the practical aspects of reforming the healthcare system to accomplish the goal that I just stated. And I think, a heated political rhetoric when you're talking healthcare is not part of that equation. Mm. I mean, what you need to work on is practical solutions that are going to be sustainable. And I think, both sides realize that. There is a fundamental difference of opinion, I think, on who should provide health insurance coverage for our citizens. But the goal is the same. So I think, the American people are also drive this. The American people are pretty much tired of, I think, mm-hmm. the political bantering back and forth and want practical solutions. And that's what I've tried to do, since I've been in Congress is, provide a practical approach to what the problem is. And on health care, I think that's been effective. So, it's spilling over into all kinds of things. I'm hoping that it'll spill over into the highway bill, for example, and mm-hmm. let's get a long-term highway bill. But it's primarily, I think, driven by the American people and really their goal of finding solutions and stopping the political bantering that's been going on for quite a while.
Which leads us, I think, to 21st century cures, which is a common sense, I think, bill. I'm going to let you walk us through the particulars of it. But the thing that I found intriguing about it last time we talked was the fact that it emerged from a committee with a 51-0 vote. I think the perception that most Americans, many Hoosiers, have right now is that you couldn't get a 51-0 vote out of Congress over, which direction the sun rises in the morning.
Yeah, there's some truth to that.
So I'd like to talk a little bit. Let's talk first about what 21st Century Cures is and then how you got to the point where everybody seemed to be, marching in the same direction for once.
Yeah, basically it started with identifying a problem, and the problem being that we need to make sure that we can get effective treatments to patients in an expedient way, mm-hmm. in a less cumbersome way. And also the second point is recognizing that, we have stayed flat on our funding for basic science research and funding medical research at the NIH, for example, for quite some time. And America has always been a leader in research and development in the medical field. But other countries are starting to catch up. And I think the recognition that we need to get things to patients more quickly, more effectively, and we need more money for research, both of those two things came together to try to develop a comprehensive approach to try to solve that problem. And that's where 21st Century Cures came into play. The House started working on it in the Energy and Commerce Committee in late 2013. Chairman Upton and Ranking Member DeGette, she's a ranking member of one of the subcommittees, got together and said, what are the problems that we can address in a practical way and get those into legislation? They then started talking to stakeholders out there. Patients, for example, have testified. about the difficulty, you know, getting advanced treatments in a more expedient way. The FDA is part of the conversation. The private sector businesses are part of the conversation. Indianapolis, for example, Eli Lilly and other companies have put their input into this situation. And that's resulted in, I think, a piece of legislation which is very comprehensive and complicated. So I'd recommend your listeners go to the Energy and Commerce website. You can just Google Energy and House Energy and Commerce Committee. Look at the website, and they'll be able to read the legislation. But in a nutshell, try to address those two problems and get through the bill in a bipartisan way so we can actually get it into law. It doesn't do you any good to have ideas if you can't get it into law.
How did you go about getting the second piece of that? It is getting to the 51-0 in the committee. I mean, you were in town just a few days ago, you and Representative Susan Brooks from this part of the state, from central Indiana, and Chairman Upton, and talked quite a bit about the rather arduous process of getting everyone on board. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think how you do that is you identify problems that are pretty common sense. You know, when you look at the process of getting things through the FDA, you look at the FDA and you see, try to address what the issues are there. And those are not partisan issues. And the issues in healthcare reform, as we've already discussed, and other areas where it's pretty clear there's going to be a partisan difference, well, you just set those aside and you say, you know, we'll address those in a different type of way. And you continue to work over a period of years, really, to try to streamline the bill to identify those things that we can all agree on. And again, the thing that we can all agree on is we need to be able to get medicine to patients or devices to patients more quickly. We need to have treatments that are more designed for specific patients. You know, we have people out there that have unusual, rare diseases, you know, and they're kind of left out there because, you know, the economics of trying to develop a cure for their problem is not there in reality. But try to, you know, that's where the federal government can be helpful because we can help in that situation for so-called orphan diseases. And these are all things that we agree on. So that's how you do it. You find the things that are nonpartisan that everybody knows need to be addressed, and you put those in there. And the things that are really divisive, you leave out. And that has, you know, been a process over the last couple of years where there's been things, look, we just can't agree on. Let's just not address that in 21st century cures. And that's how we got a 51-0 vote in the Energy and Commerce Committee for this legislation, and I suspect when we bring it to the floor, hopefully within the next month or so, we'll have broad bipartisan support. The Senate's working on similar legislation more slowly, of course, because the Senate works more slowly, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you have things like the president saying in his State of the Union address that he wants to address precision medicine and things like that, you know, that so do we. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you identify – in fact, with that speech, Chairman Upton, when the president – talked about that, Chairman Upton said, you know, this is an area where maybe we should talk to the administration and try to address it.
We might
and
be able to work together.
Yeah, and that's how it works. That's how it ends up that way.
We've talked a lot, appropriately, obviously, about the impact it will have on patients and on saving lives and improving people's health care options. There also is a jobs and economic development implication to this bill, too.
There is.
Right? Could you talk a little bit about why it's important from those perspectives as well?
Yeah, well, it's important because companies are telling us that they're having trouble, you know, getting innovative products to the marketplace in the U.S. Compared to Europe, for example, because of the arduous process that their products or medications have to go through for approval. And so, you know, you've seen companies be frustrated by that and sometimes release their new products overseas first because they can get approval more quickly. And things take longer in the U.S. So from an economic development standpoint and a jobs standpoint, you know, if companies are able to develop their products right here and make the products right here in the United States and get them through the administrative review process more quickly, then they're going to be more willing to expand their operations here in the United States. That would be the premise, and hopefully create jobs and create some economic development. So that's basically the premise of why this also is a potential economic development. The other thing I forgot to mention is some companies have decided they're just going to produce their products overseas and go and take the production over there. So those jobs leave the United States because of the frustration of the review process here in the U.S.
When last we talked, I noticed you came in to talk about 21st century cures here in Indianapolis and did a media availability. And when I asked sort of about this, you know, this bipartisan approach at that time, I noticed and asked if there might be, you know, any carryover, any other areas where this approach might work. I noticed at that time you did a gesture. It doesn't work so well on radio, so I'm going to have to describe it.
Sure.
Because people can't see it. But you sort of did a, you know, point a finger and affirmative thing. You're now in your third term, right?
That's correct.
As a member of Congress. When you came in, obviously the partisanship was white hot between
it sure was
in D.C. And just talking with you, you know, we haven't talked at length. This is probably the longest we've ever talked in our lives. You strike me as a fairly practical guy, not relentlessly ideological, more pragmatic than that. How frustrating was it to work in that environment where, you know, let's face it, there were a lot of politicians on both sides, I think, who much preferred a fight to a solution, and that doesn't strike me as you.
No, that isn't me, and you know, the reality is the 112th Congress, which I came in 2011, was difficult. And I think it was difficult on both sides of the aisle. When you talk to Democrats that I've worked with, they were frustrated by it too. But like you said, the partisanship was white hot across the country. The American people were pretty white hot on a partisan basis, you know. But once that kind of settled out, I think what you see is, you know, people like me who gave up their career to go to Congress. You know, I didn't go there to accomplish nothing, or I would have stayed as a heart surgeon because every day I'm accomplishing, you know, a lot on the individual patients that I took care of. So, you know, I think it's a good thing. The 114th Congress, which we're in right now, you're seeing, you know, people sticking by their principles. People have political beliefs, no doubt about it. But people trying to look through all of that and trying to find areas where we can agree. And I think that 21st Century Cures is one of those. We were able to repeal the sustainable growth rate way that Medicare pays physicians, which has been a bugaboo for 15 years, you know, the so-called doc fix that we've been doing every year. That was – we found bipartisan consensus suddenly on that, you know, between Speaker Boehner and Ms. Pelosi, and all of a sudden, within a month's time, it went through and signed by the president. Some of that was because of the Doc Caucus and others pushing to get that done. But the reality is both sides recognize, look, this is a problem that the American people are tired of. You know, they're tired of hearing how seniors are going to lose access to care, how doctors are going to take a big pay cut and worry about, you know, whether their physician is going to see them anymore. And you know, the American people at the end of the day drive Congress. I mean, we're a reflection of the American people. Right now, the American people are at a place where they want results. And yes, they have their beliefs. And yes, they should stick by them individually and as I do. But within that range of what, you know, what your philosophy is and what your beliefs are, there's common ground to be found. And that's what we're looking for, and that's coming up soon on the highway bill, for example. You know, at the end of July, the federal highway program funding is going to be broke. And if we don't extend that, you know, all of a sudden the money coming to the state of Indiana to NDOT, to, you know, Department of Transportation to fund their projects ends. So, you know, we're at the point right now where we need to find a bipartisan solution, and I think we can get there.
If you are just joining us, we are in the middle of a recorded conversation with United States Representative Larry Bouchon. He's a Republican who represents Southwest Indiana. Because this is a recorded show, we're not taking questions or comments via phone, email, or social media. in terms of this, the areas that you are finding agreement on, you've mentioned Affordable Care Act, 21st Century Cures, Highway Bill. The other, are there any other big areas where you can see that you might be able to work with the administration?
You know, right now, I mean, those are the big issues. I think, you know, we're struggling a little bit on the budget side, but I do think defense spending, you know, how we fund our military, making sure that we continue to have a strong military and also the intelligence community, and making sure that we have the things in place to protect the American people. For example, the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. There were issues related to personal privacy that came to light. And everybody knew that. And so we were just recently able to pass in the House and the Senate and get to the president a reform bill as it relates to the Patriot Act that continues to make sure that our intelligence agencies can protect the American people, but also make sure that people's privacy is protected. That was a bipartisan solution that came together based on the fact that the American people wanted us to do both of those things, protect our personal safety, protect the safety of the country, and also our personal privacy. So I think areas related to defending our country, the military, the intelligence community, those are areas we've found common ground. And so, you know, I'm hopeful on the budget side as it relates to, and part of that's 21st Century Cures, making sure we fund our research and development agencies like the NIH. I think we can agree on those things. And there are others, I think, smaller issues that we can agree on that happen really every day. So I'm pretty optimistic, really.
How much of this is a product? We seem to be entering into an era in American politics in which, you know, Democrats surge in the presidential election years when they have high turnouts.
Yeah.
Republicans surge then in the off-year elections, so that, you know, the two parties each have sort of their areas of advantage and don't seem to be able to prevail in the other years, so they've got to learn to work together.
I think that's true. If you look back through history, the American people like divided government. I mean, they really do. I mean, if you look at the Reagan era, we had divided government, and I think working with Tip O'Neill, President Reagan was able to accomplish some things. Same thing's true during the Clinton era. Working with Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton had some big policy successes, you know, with welfare reform and balancing budget. So I think the American people like divided government, and they like us to work together. And so we'll see where that takes us.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with United States Representative Larry Bouchon. He's a Republican from Southwest Indiana. This is a recorded conversation, so we're not taking calls, emails, or comments or questions via social media. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're in the middle of a recorded conversation with United States Representative Larry Bouchon. He's a Republican from Southwest Indiana. Because this is a recorded conversation, we're not taking calls or questions by phone, via email, or through social media. But we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. We talked a little bit about how there is a new spirit of, if not completely bipartisanship, at least maybe more and more grudging accommodation on both sides.
That may be a good way to put it.
The acknowledgement that, okay, both parties are here. Neither one of them is going away. And that a lot of the anger seem to be dissipating out of the conversation. We are still seeing, though, really highly charged issues, and I'd like to talk about the political climate. I mean, here in Indiana, obviously, with the battle over same-sex marriage and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, we're obviously now also having a huge national conversation about race and violence, you know, that has followed the tragic shootings and horrible story down in Charleston, South Carolina. Could you talk a little bit about how we get past all of that. I mean, I realize in terms of the state politics, you don't have a direct role in terms of implementing policy there. But I think most politicians and most elected officials would agree that they have a responsibility to exert some moral leadership there. How much damage, let's start with the Same-Sex Marriage and Religious Freedom Restoration Act battle here in Indiana. How much damage do you think that did the state?
I think in the short term somewhat, but I think in the long term probably not a lot. I think it's a national debate, and the Supreme Court's going to rule probably this week mm-hmm. on the constitutionality of that, and I hope that helps settle some of that issue. So I don't think in the long term, people recognize what type of people we are here in Indiana. People know that we're in the Midwest, we're friendly, we have a very very friendly business environment. I don't think that has changed. I think that, in the short run, we took a little bit of hit to our reputation. But I think in the long term, I don't think there'll be any significant damage. And I do think, I'll leave it to the people that are elected to govern our state to decide what the way forward is. But I think in Washington, D.C., that Indiana has a lot of respect for the way our state has been managed financially. And also from a regulatory standpoint, to make it a very, very business-friendly state. So that said, I think, some of the bigger national issues, I think, need to be addressed on an ongoing basis. We've made, as the president has said, dramatic advances in race relations over the last number of decades. We still have, situations where you're going to have people like this person in South Carolina who clearly is an outlier. Clearly has views that are not consistent with, almost every American. Mm-hmm. And you just need to continue to address those and make sure that when we talk about those issues, that we talk about people, that we talk about, we're all in this together type conversation. Clearly, it was a tragedy in South Carolina, and I've talked to some of the reps from down there about that situation. But I think what we need to do on both sides of whatever discussion we're having, whether it's that or any other, is keep the rhetoric down. Let's talk about solutions to problems that we can agree on. And I think that's what the American people want. I think it's very unfortunate that we continue to have some residuals of these problems out there, but I think they're overall, we've made dramatic advances, but we need to be vigilant. And we need to recognize that most problems in societies, throughout history, aren't ever completely solved. Mm-hmm. People have to continue an ongoing vigilant process to make sure that we're addressing them every day.
Should the Supreme Court have resolved this question earlier? I mean, they dealt with the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, I think personally so. The Supreme Court probably, at the end of the day, should have left it to the states individually to decide. My personal view is issues like this should be left to the states, in each individual state, to address. That said, the Supreme Court is the top court in the land, and I'll look forward to their ruling, and I think that, we will have respect for their ruling, whichever way they decide. But I do think on a lot of these issues, I think that the Supreme Court probably should allow the states to address these type of social issues. But that said, we'll see what they say.
Well, I guess where I was going with that is when the Supreme Court ruled on the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, it said that the federal DOMA created, insurmountable Fifth Amendment problems, and that the federal government obviously could not violate people's Fifth Amendment rights.
And I respect that ruling. I mean, it's which the highest court. You know, they make that decision, I think.
But it leaves open the question, if the federal government, how could a state government? A state government can't waive someone's Fifth Amendment's rights either.
Fair enough. You have to realize, you know, during the President Clinton signed that into law, you know. Yeah. So in the
there's enough guilt to go around there.
So there's, the thing is society changes over time. So I think, you know, we have to, again, just like addressing the race issue, you know, these are ongoing processes that we need to have respect for the American people on this issue that we're talking about now, and see, you know, as times change, I think you'll see even the Supreme Court changing with the time to a certain extent. And so, you know, we'll see. I mean, I your point is very valid. But I think, you know, the Supreme Court will have to address that. Federal law and state law frequently are not, you know, consistent with each other on a multitude of issues. And so we'll have to see how that goes and see what they say on this particular case.
And, you know, just recently, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley just said that they support removing the Confederate flag. That's, you know, provoked another national debate about how we deal with our history.
Yeah.
It's one that has some Indiana implications. You know, this state, while we obviously during the Civil War remained with the Union, that was not a consensus position.
Understood.
In the state that, you know, Governor Morton pretty much had to send the state legislature home and rule almost as a dictator because he was afraid that they'd vote to sit the war out and all of that. And Indiana had a very divided role in that. The argument for maintaining the Confederate flag has always been, well, it is part of our history and it is part of our heritage, and therefore, you know, it needs to be acknowledged that we don't take, you know, we haven't stopped thinking about George Washington or Thomas Jefferson because they were slaveholders. On the other side of that, the argument now is that it has become, you know, a symbol, particularly to a lot of these racist groups. There's no other way to describe them, racist groups.
Right.
And we need to acknowledge that. The time has moved on. I guess, you know, with those uglier parts of our racial history, how do you think we should deal with them? Because this is obviously going to be a question that's going to preoccupy us for a while.
Yeah, I think, you know, a significant portion of our citizens in the United States see the Confederate flag as a symbol of racism, mm-hmm. as a symbol of all of the issues relating to that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as times change, it appears, you know, the majority of the American people are beginning to take that view of the Confederate flag. That said, there's a substantial portion of people that live in the South. I'm not from the South, but so I don't mm-hmm. want to speak for them, but that see it as part of their history. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, that from a government perspective, you can continue to hold your own personal views about a certain issue. But when you start to look at the broader group of people that you represent, I think you need to take into consideration the fact that on this particular issue, for example, that, you know, the significant majority of people see it as divisive.
Mm-hmm.
And that said, you can see why the governor of South Carolina and Senator Graham have come out and said, you know what, from a symbol standpoint, I think they still recognize it as part of their history of their state, but they also recognize the fact that it is seen as divisive. Mm-hmm. And with all of the past history behind the Confederate flag, you know, continuing to have that at the State House is most likely not an appropriate thing to do from a governmental perspective. And again, I don't want to speak for them, but
mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, as times change, you know, the country changes. And I think we need to respect the fact that, again, that many people see the Confederate flag as a symbol of past failures as it relates to race, and so it needs to be addressed.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with United States Representative Larry Bouchon. He is a Republican from Southwest Indiana. This is a recorded conversation, so we're not taking calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. You've mentioned a couple of times during this conversation that, and made my own personal view, but you also make it clear that you acknowledge the views of your constituency. That part of serving as an elected official has always fascinated me. Are there any of your views, personal views, that you would say aren't necessarily in step with your constituents, and how do you resolve that when you do?
Yeah, I think, I don't want to get into some of my personal views on certain subjects.
But the reality, I'm asking for an example, not the laundry list.
I understand. There are some. Let's just say the Affordable Care Act. I mean, there's a substantial portion of the people that I represent that think it's the right approach to health care reform. I've made it pretty clear. My personal view is as a healthcare provider, that I don't think that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, from a representative standpoint, representing the people, I recognize that people support parts of the law, and that that the entire law has some positive effect on the people that I represent, and therefore I take a pragmatic approach to when I try to address problems related to the Affordable Care Act. I think that's just one example. I think, for the most part, I think people like me stick with their personal values, their moral values and what they believe in. And on a lot of the bigger issues, people have to also look at, what the greater good for the people they represent may be. And sometimes that may be in conflict with your own personal views, just like at home. I mean, if you're at home, there are things that you may personally think are a great idea, but the rest of your family doesn't. I mean, it's a very similar concept, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes I think you have to take a pragmatic approach and realize that, not everyone always agrees, and then you try to find common ground where you can agree on it. And the areas that I see my job partially. The areas that you may disagree with, it's your charge as an elected official to try to message to the people that you represent why you feel a certain way about a certain issue, and talk about the facts and what type of things are driving your belief, and try to message that. And sometimes, you may be in different than the majority of the people that you represent. Sometimes you still have to stick with that. But it's our charge to communicate that to the people that we represent, not to be, out there isolated and not communicating. That's why we have a very aggressive communications program, why we do constituent services in an aggressive way, trying to reach out to people. Mm-hmm. Why I do town halls to listen, why I do roundtables to listen. And, on the areas that I think maybe in a little bit different than maybe the majority of the people that I represent, I try to influence the direction of the people in my district with facts and information. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Do you enjoy serving in Congress?
I do.
And if you do, what do you like about it? Nothing is ever an unmixed blessing. I think you can know what the second part of that question is.
Yeah.
What part do you not like? But what parts do you like about
it? Yeah, I like the legislative process. I like trying to identify problems and solving them. I think that 21st Century Cures, for example, is a big one. For me as a healthcare provider, getting this doc fix permanently fixed so we don't have to have the worries that seniors are going to lose access or doctors are going to take huge pay cuts and drop Medicare from their patients, for example. Those are the parts that I like, the legislative process. And the other thing I like is interacting with people. As a healthcare provider, one of the biggest things I miss is interacting with the patients and the families. I like interacting with people and hearing their views and talking to them about their problems. The part I dislike is I don't like the hyper-partisan relationship sometimes that comes along with it. You know, I don't like reading negative things about myself in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. That's part of the job.
How hard was it to get used to that?
It was a little difficult, yeah. But, you know, there's a learning curve there. And after a while, I think you just say, well, people have a right to their viewpoint as long as they, you know, are factually based and not, you know, not lying about you, for example, that, you know, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I occasionally will respond back, you know, in the newspaper with a response to people say if they're factually not correct in what they're saying. But I recognize that, you know, everyone has their viewpoint and it's a free country and they should express that. And I listen.
Do you see this as a sort of a long-term career change for you, or do you see yourself going back to the practice of medicine at some point?
I see it as a career change as far as being involved in public policy. I don't see it as a career change as being in Congress forever.
Okay.
I think, you know, I plan to be in Congress as long as the people of the 8th District will reelect me, but within limits. I really see myself doing something after Congress, probably in healthcare policy, but probably not really going back to the practice of medicine.
Well, I think that will have to be the last word. U.S. Representative Larry Bouchon, really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you for doing this. As we have said, this is a recorded conversation, which means we weren't taking calls or questions via phone, email, or social media, but we will be back live with our next show. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.